and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben, and with me today is Duncan.
Hello.
Just Duncan.
Just
in the new
me.
Year, we only have 1.5 hosts because I'm tired and recovering from my illness still, and hopefully that doesn't make you all too worried about me.
It should instead make you worried about Jeff.
Yeah. Yeah. The internet transmitted diseases are pretty bad.
Yeah.
But no, we're going to talk about last season, and we're going to talk about what we're excited about for next season. So yes, the fall and winter 2024 and 2025 respectively. Mm. And to start, I think we'll start with the glitziest stuff, because I know we both watched Ranma 1/2, and I don't know if you have much of a history with Rumiko Takahashi, besides being around me while I watched two different versions of Urusei Yatsura. But yeah, I liked it. What did you think?
I mean, I enjoyed it more than I did Urusei Yatsura, I think. I mean, the obvious thing is, like, you have a more likable core pair.
Yeah.
That, yeah, strangely enough, it makes your show more watchable. For better or worse, it plays on the fact it is, if not out of time, then it has a retro aesthetic. It doesn't try and update its themes or its sensibilities, really. And mm-hmm. I think some people will have problems with, probably relate to that. But this is like the human upscaled version of an anime. High definition, brilliant colors, smooth action.
Yes, if Andy was here, I'm sure he would be talking about how great the colors are and how good the designs are and how they've, like, softened them and this and that. I agree. I think I don't have a relationship with Ranma 1/2 except being vaguely aware of it and making jokes about it. And so I have to be very careful to keep in mind that it might just be a matter of baggage that distinguishes Urusei Yatsura from Ranma 1/2. But I do agree the ensemble is stronger. The premise is better because it doesn't involve just some guy cheating on this, like, cute, devoted alien.
Yeah.
There are issues. I think that often the pacing is kind of weird because, say, in the ice skating fight, there are scenes where they just have to last long enough for someone to deliver a multi-sentence monologue describing what's happening. And that can mean that some of this stuff is just feels impossibly protracted.
Oh, yeah.
But generally, it's light, it's snappy. I like Ranma and Akane. I think Shampoo is great. When talking about updating sensibilities, I do wonder if her being a, like, Chinese national without a great command of Japanese featured more in the original manga or the original anime adaptation. But here we've got no embarrassing battle athletes victory Black Lagoon Chinese stereotypes. She's just, like, a force of chaos who's operating according to her own rules, which keeps it from just being Ranma and Akane getting close and then Ranma saying something stupid or an outside force intervening and Akane punches Ranma in the head or dumps water on him and turns him into her. I dread the parade of supporting characters that will come, but it's not fair of me to judge the season we had based on what I feel the ultimate trajectory of all Rumiko Takahashi joints are.
It's just like one of those shots, you just, like, a figure in the foreground surrounded by these silhouettes in the background, and you just feel the pressure of the cast to come looming behind you, here to fill the 24 episodes with their each and every one of their introductory stories.
Right. And back in the old days, you'd have the OP and you'd be teasing all the characters who are going to come. And they don't do that anymore. But I do think it would be funny to have a version of the Ranma 1/2 OP that's just got, here's every character who gets at least one episode about them just popping up. It'll be like in Trigun when the like huge guy with the mohawk and the mechanical arm is just in the OP. And it's like, oh yeah, he's the episode one villain. Here's Wolfwood too. I guess he's coming in at some point. That sort of thing. But I'm going to watch more. I didn't end up as nearly upset with it as I did with Urusei Yatsura. I do think I like Lum more than any given character in Ranma 1/2, but the ensemble is what counts here. Like, you can't just you can't carry yourself through Rumiko Takahashi just loving one character so much that it makes up for all the annoying dynamics. So this is better. I'm optimistic, even though I didn't sound like it.
It has a charm to it, which feels authentic. Whereas at times, I think Yuasa Yatsura felt a bit forced. It's so retro. It's so cool. Whereas this is just like charming. I love that little moment before every episode starts where it's like you get the narrator come along and he says he is Satomi Ranma of the Anything Goes Martial Arts School. She is Tendo Akane, and she'll just go and get angry at him and credits roll. And it's just this nice reaffirming of the underlying relationship which all this revolves around. That's your core. It's like this and love and antagonism between the two, and it's I think you have to say that there is more reciprocal, like
they like each other as opposed to like
they just like, who would have thought love story improved by the characters liking each other?
Love story improved by one of the characters not being a compulsive cheater who is never happy with anything. That just might be. And speaking of love stories where the characters actually like each other, even though they may not always treat each other as if they like each other, we did cover Dan to Dan a lot in the end of year wrap up. But I do just want to give a hat tip to this. This was my favorite anime of last season. And that, as much as I love Monogatari, as much as I enjoyed tuning into Ranma every week, neither of them can hold a candle to just this great shonen battler adventure as like crypto love story. I love these two kids. I love Okurun and Momo. I any anime that has a Gyaru who seems rude and crude, but she's actually like super like sweet and feminine inside, just always grabs my heart. And this is one of the best executions. And I appreciate the threat of sexual violence being kind of a metaphor for how scary it is to give yourself over to this person. And like when they spend time together, they're attacked by these aliens that, you know, trying to steal their banana or their balls or what have you. And just like, rarely do I feel castration anxiety is to a larger thematic purpose, but in this case it is. And I think it really works. And, despite the like absolutely criminal cliffhanger at the end of the core, I'm looking forward to more.
we sort of discussed like problems that cliffhanger has, both in terms of pacing, like brakes screeching to a halt out of nowhere, and also like Okron's in like a suspenseful position, but Momo's not quite getting fridged, but it's time to imply peril to our heroine. What form will that peril take? Can you guess, everyone? It's sexual violence.
It's been very weird to recommend this to friends who I know will like it because of its like stylishness and be like, also like the first 10 minutes of the first episode are going to be a lot, but it never gets that bad. But also it never goes away. Be prepared.
Do appreciate that it aims to be messy, but I would not criticize anyone who goes like that. Messes reminds me too much of people I know or things I've seen or whatever.
Or they're just tired of anime using sexual danger as a way to like give the female characters like emotional and personal depth. So
popular media likes to use violence against women as a way of motivating a hero. And I'm glad that in this, that Momo is more than capable of looking after herself. They're a duo. They're not like one looking after the other. I would not expect Momo to be saved from her situation. I would expect Momo to get herself out of the situation we left her in, which I think maybe speaks to naivety on my part, but I hope not. I hope she's allowed to just kick some lecherous butt.
Anime makes fools of us all, but hopefully not in this respect.
I also watched a far more conventional romance last season, which is Blue Box. It's a prestige sports romance, and I'm not sure what else to call it when something other than prestige, when a show just gets adapted and you know it's getting unlimited budget, and you can see it in every frame. Like, it's another genre mashup, just like Dan Da Dan. Like, you've got combination of first love and teenage obsessions, but instead of aliens, it's basketball and badminton here, which is obviously a far more mundane battle than the supernatural kind, but it still provides a dramatic thread. And I think that is actually a really strong point to it. These two genres really cover each other's weaknesses, because when you are following someone's first crush and the exhilaration and that even small intimacies can bring in that context, you could easily slow down to a glacial pace.
Yeah.
But when you've got a badminton tournament and a basketball tournament going on parallel, they drag you along, even in what could become a typically chaste high school love story.
Yeah, they can't kimi ni todoke you if there's sports to be won.
It looks impeccable as well. Like, this is a gorgeous, like, sparkling, sunlit, it's adolescence. But sadly, however, someone in the production team is so piss scared of their character designs getting ruined by a tiny piece of string in a badminton net, that's my personal pet peeve among all anime rears its ugly head again. And whenever someone is interposed between a net and a human face, a hole magically appears in it.
It's the worst solution. I get it, but it's the worst solution, and they should go back to the drawing board.
You've spent so much time and care building up a vermisitude and like a feeling of being present, and then you're like, hey, you've got to make sure you see this face properly. So, voomph, that's all gone. Nothing else matters. And like, no, you've, and you know what really pisses me off? In the OP, they don't do it. Like, there's a shot.
Because they have more money there.
Ben, it's not even a case of money. They're deleting something. They're literally creating more, like, all Annette is it's a separate layer.
Yeah, and they just take the erase tool and just...
It actually takes more effort to erase a hole in that layer than it does to create that layer. And it's like, why go for more effort to achieve a worse result? I do not know. It's an anime crime, and someone will go to anime jail for this.
I will say, so I have noticed that a lot of, like, more directorly animes do tend to, like, kind of really be obsessed with, like, framing. And, like, it's good. Like, Makine, I remember, had a lot of, like, the camera is put back from the action, and there's a foreground frame and maybe like background to like kind of heighten the sense of scale. And so I do wonder if it's a lot of people looking at the net and saying, this shouldn't be a blocker, this should be a frame, and just kind of taking that too far. Like, I understand, like, you want to kind of have this sense of being viewed and kind of have the externality and like watching the character at a distance to kind of appreciate their position within the environment. But sometimes things block your vision and great stuff. Like, I was watching the first Zatoichi movie back in 1962. Wow. Absolutely amazing. It's very slow. He just comes in and he's just trying to bilk the local Yakuza member for like money while refusing to fight. So it's kind of like a subversion of Yojimbo. And of course there's the whole, like, is he actually blind? But they don't fuck it up like they do the Beat Takeshi remake. But there are times if you're going to be using the camera as a voyeur, sometimes you have to let the action be obscured. If you're going to use the camera as an eye, sometimes the eye doesn't see things. Mm. And I think that's a lot of what happens when you rage at chain link fences and nets and the like, not actually obscuring the action, because I do think it actually enhances. I wish that they found a better solution. That was a tangent to note, fruitful conclusion.
It was just a lament.
But yeah, like, I mean, there's so many times that like anime abandons like artful direction for pure readability. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating when it's a high dollar thing where they don't have to choose. Like, I'm not going to complain if like, not going to complain if some Gohan's production is going to be like, going to delete stuff. But if you've got the dollars to just, you know, set one of your animators on figuring out how to make this scene where someone's behind a volleyball net work. Anyway.
Obviously, we don't want to get hung up on that little thing, because it is a good show. And as I was saying, like, I think that cross-genre thing really does work, because just as the weaknesses of a slow romance are sort of solved by a quick sports anime, some of the weaknesses of sports animes are solved by having a romance, because we get greater interiority in co-leads Taki and Chinatsu, because on the surface, they're both fairly normal anime sports protagonists, like, you know, hardworking, quick learning. But because we get to see who they care about and why they care about them, we get their quirks and their insecurities and an idea of what would motivate them on a particular playing field. I'd be remiss though to finish talking about this, so if I didn't mention why the second half of this season spiked for me and why I'm kind of intrigued by it going forward, which is Gymnast, Gremlin, and generally self-aware losing heroine Hina.
You're having a losing heroine season, it feels like.
I am so having that losing heroine. Like, she's just has absolute determination to go down swinging. And you know, Ben, I will stan a girl who confesses knowing she's going to be rejected, and it's no different here. And normally I would consider her doomed, because being the third wheel in a love story is not a happy thing. But this isn't just a romance show, it's also a sports show. And sports shows like their underdogs. And so maybe, Ben, there's a small, infinitesimal chance.
What are you doing to yourself, Duncan? Oh my goodness. I respect it because it engages with like, you're not just being a burnt out person seeing tropes. You're like letting it get you excited. But no, first girl rule is ironclad.
No, she's technically his childhood friend and therefore true first girl.
We're getting into Nisekoi territory there. Like, that's one thing I respect about Nisekoi. It's just like, well, what if he had an earlier childhood friend? And what if that childhood friend actually has amnesia and she used to be, oh God.
Good old romance. What else?
I wish Nisekoi was better. Anyways, let's keep going.
One thing worth saying is I think for the first time in a long while, this might be the first season where I have as many shows from Netflix as I do from Crunchyroll, which is a very interesting shift. Normally, you'd see an interesting anime and you'd say you wouldn't be able to recommend it to a general audience because people might think of trying to watch an anime, but they're not going to pay a subscription to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Ranma, Dan to Dan, Blue Box, all Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a sea change in the accessibility of anime to most people.
Yeah, and there's some really artsy stuff on there. Like, I just watched Mononoke, and I really liked it. Oh my god, the
good old medicine.
The one with the abused wife. Like, I was crying for the last two episodes, just intermittently. Powerful stuff. But that's on Netflix, and they're helping produce a movie trilogy adaptation. It's good. Like, every so often, Netflix is like, we should become a hub for anime in the West, and it's like, cool, yeah. Pay for weird art shit, make like prestige anime like Dan to Dan and Blue Box available to the masses. I appreciate it because, like you said, it's hard to be like, you can watch this anime, but you have to sign up for a free trial with a service that is only about anime. So sorry if you're, you know, not like insane maniac who's completely devoted to the genre, to the medium.
Mm. And we have things like Beastars, which got its a final season starting in fall. And that, I think, has partially not been talked about as much because the manga itself has quite a bad reputation for fumbling its finale.
No.
And I think people are like, oh, well, it's not really that much point in watching this. And then people start saying, seems to be diverging. Seems to be doing things slightly differently to how it was written. Now, how far and wide that goes, I'm not sure yet. Because there's no way of telling, but I have, Ben, this small bit of hope that we might be getting an anime originally ending, because I'd be really interested to see what someone like Paru Itagaki, who is a very singular voice, would do if she's given a second shot at something. Because so rarely does a creator have a chance to go, okay, take two. And do something different. And for it not to be a choice imposed from the outside, for it to be something where she's working as part of the creative process to recontextualize and craft a new ending. And for someone like her, who seems very keen to self-examine, I can imagine it turning out quite different. And if not better, then certainly interesting. Yeah.
I hope you're right. I think that the stink of an anime original ending from at this point decades ago is just too much for anyone to risk. But I really would love to see more adaptations of manga with underwhelming endings. Like, as you said, take that second stab. Like, see what works. Use the strengths of the medium. Because you can do a lot of more abstract, like emotionally grounded stuff with animation, I think, because like you can do vibes, you can do painting over nostalgic locations with music in a way that you can't really do with manga. It would be great.
The risk is obviously that it becomes self-indulgent, but feel like she's a strong enough voice to not fall prey to that. Something which was self-indulgent, which I watched this season, though, was a One Piece fan letter, which is a short one-off story which is set within the world of One Piece, which is about how normal people's lives living within that universe is shaped by outsized heroes and villains. And it is all killer, no filler, absolute sizzle reel. Just go watch it. I mean, I know you care not one bit about One Piece, Ben, but I recommend it even to you, that you cannot go wrong with 20 odd minutes of absolutely show-stopping animation with a solid short story to drag it along, and very little to no knowledge of the franchise needed. And if a listener happens to love One Piece, they're probably going, yeah, but there's all these amazing references as well, which speak to fans of the genre. And I go, yeah, cool for you, mate. I don't care. It was still amazing without them. And I think that is an incredibly high recommendation for something that it can go, you know, fuck all about this. You know everything about this. You're still both going to enjoy it. I'm sad Andy couldn't make it today, because I know he's loved the current arc that One Piece is going through. And he probably would have found dozens of things in it which resonated with him. Knowing Andy, probably made him cry, because he is an easy cry.
He should have skipped leg day. This is his fault. This is on him.
Yeah. What next? I'm going to blast through things I have the least to say about, then finish on Orb. Hopefully that gives you a chance to say something.
I'll try not to be cranky.
No, you can be cranky. Cranky is fine. Cranky is fine, Ben. you can discuss your feelings about crankiness when we get to it.
So my problem is just that, like, so there's the quarter to three episode on Prometheus where just Kelly Wand does this, like, I'm tired of this faith versus science shit. It's the least interesting way to approach this question. And that was back in 2013, and all I ever do is seem to quote a rant by an absolutely burnt out stoner, because I'm tired of this faith versus science shit. It's a lie that was sold to us in the Bush years. And anyway, no, I'll try to find a good place to approach it.
Yeah, actually, screw it. We're going there now. Okay, Ben,
cool.
At the end of the season, you remarked, no, you can't make me watch it. No. I know I can't make you watch Orb on Movements of the Earth, but I can tell you why I actually enjoyed it, and I think it might have been the strongest anime of last season to me. So here's the thing. I'm here to tell you that this is a show who gave me a journey to follow, an idea passing through a chain of human connections, changing them and being changed in turn. And that sort of majesty of the passing of time and the small role human lives have in it can be a very difficult thing to capture. But I think this manages it. Its main disadvantage as a recommendation, and I think what has ended up not necessarily prejudicing you against it, but certainly making you recoil a little bit, is that its first three episodes are basically its writer trying to punch his way out of his own elevator pitch. And where he's decided, right, this is how I hook a sign-in audience into thinking about a show about the intertwined nature of personal and scientific truth. We're going to have a bit of blood and torture, people. Hey, let's go.
Yeah.
And I'm really torn on whether those three episodes are needed as a setup or not. Whether, as Tom Chick would say, they are good writing or bad writing. Because they feature characters who are at their most elemental and unsubtle. And worse for that, for me, our lens for viewing them seems initially created from a very modern mindset, like one which sort of takes the ignorance and dogma of the church as given and the rationality and rightness of heliocentrism as granted. We've got this genius student, Raphael, and this cynical inquisitor, Novak, and they're both very united in their belief that their actions are rational in the face of a church that has centralized power. Like, Raphael initially is like, okay, I just keep my head down. I study theology because that's what my teacher tells me to. And I live an easy life. Novak is like, I work for the church. They maintain order. The only way my child has a good life is if order's maintained. At the start of this arc, Raphael walks past a heretic being burned and comments to himself, it's their own fault. They're given a chance to repent. Why not just say you repent? It doesn't matter if you believe it. Just say it. And by the time we leave those three episodes, we see him making that exact same irrational choice, the one he derided. I'm really unsure if this is good writing, because that kind of self-sacrificing ideal represents a really fundamental devotion and conviction that is very unrelatable to a point that I have a hard time engaging with it. But at the same time, it brings out the same reaction in Novak that it did in me. He's like, why are you doing this, kid? He doesn't understand, like, I gave you the chance to get out of this. Why didn't you take it? And it's very interesting to have the setup show the person who we are initially, we're led to believe is on the side of rationality, on the side of logic and science, making an irrational choice based on a belief in something greater than himself. And the guy who is set up as siding with faith and all that represents being confounded. And I think that's not what people expected. It's not what I expected their two arcs to go. Mm. And it's, regardless of how I feel about those three episodes, I feel it is good setup because it makes that everyone who follows feel more rounded and as comparison. Like, I really enjoyed watching like a weary mercenary like finding hope in the concept that if heliocentrism is true, that the earth is within heaven rather than beneath it. Like, just this
that's cool
concept that this idea raises us up instead of crushing us down. And like this monk who has like this feigned arrogance and brittle self-confidence that finally breaks in a moment of compassion and empathy. And then we also get to meet Novak's daughter, the person who he's doing all these horrible things for, and to see the education he's given her makes her develop her intellect in a way that she can't find any recognition, and where she's left gaining this knowledge she can't do anything with, and her joy and fulfillment when she finds other people she can talk to who on a level was really great. It is still an anime. It's not Vinland Saga, which like transcends its medium. But
unfortunately, that's what I always compare it unfavorably to. So I'll try not to in my response.
But I think it was it's surprisingly good, Ben.
I believe you. I've heard too many people say that it's good for me not to believe it's good. This is just me and my baggage. If y'all listen to this podcast regularly, you've heard my Bright Ages shtick. You've heard my frustration that we don't always like get to see the complexity of the medieval church at the same time a reforming power that is humbling secular abuses among princes and monarchs, and at the same time kind of a normative power that is shaping the intellectual currents of an entire society, of multiple entire societies. But I'm just tired of seeing the Inquisition as the face of the Church Ascendant. Like, for every Roman or Spanish or Polish inquisitor who's just torturing people for not being able to recite the Nicene Creed, there's tons of examples of passionate pastoral care. Just anything that wafts of faith versus science stuff, anything that depicts the church generally as a force for ignorance, except for the actions of a few valiant heterodox priests. It gets under my skin. And I understand that, like, it's unfair to ask this of anime. Like, I'm talking about The Green Knight or the Wolf Hall adaptations. I need to watch The Mirror and the Light, which has just finished airing recently.
Yeah.
That's just where I should look for this. And I, like, no one needs a medievalist on a podcast cranky about historical accuracy, because you'll never be satisfied. It's like getting too into guns, and then every time you watch a gun anime, you're just like, ugh. But worse, because...
Are we going there, then?
Because it's me. No, I mean, did we? Did I accidentally do a segue?
Yeah, I think you did.
Oh, God
damn it. I think there's no escaping it. I think we're going to the world of Gun Girl. Gun Gale. I say Gun Girl. It's, of course, Gun Gale Online.
Yeah, I have to acknowledge that Gun Gale Online was something, like, they accidentally made an anime for me, and once they realized that, they ran away from it. And the second season, we're not dealing with the kind of digital dysphoria between your online avatar and what people think of them versus your real life self. Yeah. And how you relate to other people who you only know through your online avatars. I liked that. I liked the tactics. I liked the gunplay. I thought Pito was a great antagonist. I mean, Yandere Rich Girl is kind of overplayed, but sure. Like, it's, I'm not watching some great work of fiction. I'm watching a mid-budget isekai, digital isekai.
Oh,
joint,
let's not go into
fuck it. Online stories about online worlds are necessarily isekai. If anyone is fighting against that because it's magic rather than technology creating the alternate world, I don't know what to tell you. Like, your definitions are too rigid.
You can tell me, because okay, Ben, I can understand popular culture making this argument, because when the two biggest entries in this genre are Sword Art Online and Log Horizon, and they both use contrived situations to trap people within a game world, then, yeah, you are turning it into a second life. But when people can just log out, walk around...
What if the anime never shows them logging out, which is the problem with this season? One of the problems with Gun Gale Online season...
Yes, that's the problem with season two. Season one did, and that's why it was good. It was not... It didn't try and be an isekai, whereas season two did, and that's why it's ruined.
Yeah, well, because also we're supposed to believe that Pito has this, like, profound trauma from not getting to kill herself in a video game, and now she's... Anyway, the moment-to-moment business of the episodes was boring. I'm tired of video games turning guns into magic, having a sniper who making her own bullets means that she's firing tank shells out of her sniper rifle. So it failed to me on a granular, like, low scale level. I also think these characters are done growing.
Yeah.
And one of the weird things about the final arc with these supposed NPCs who are in fact spoilers, but you shouldn't watch this show, so I don't actually even feel that usual twinge I do when I say spoilers. They're real special forces guys who are freaked out by how crazy and awesome our protagonists are fighting them, and how they're willing to, like, risk harm and do these absurd tactics, and ends up just, like, making a guy who's never known defeat just, like, shell-shocked in his bed because crazy little pink girl killed herself so that she could kill him. It's tough because I feel like we've now reached a point after the first season where these characters are static. Pito doesn't change. So. She has stuff that's weighing on her, but she's not moving to address it. We don't see her change or reconsider any of her beliefs. In fact, I think it would be a betrayal of Pito's character to change her mind. And Len, we have these hints in the brief number of real life scenes where people are trying to, like, make her as confident in real life as she is in the game. If the season had been more about that, I would have liked that. But it's not. We just have these characters who are just stuck with their own psychological hangups playing a video game, and to me that is not a story, that is just real life, and not in a sort of, like, authentic cinema verite way. It's just watching these people do dumb tournaments and, like, the dramatic pressure being like, are they going to lose? I don't care. They'll win because they're the protagonists, or they'll lose because the show decided they needed to, like, lose so they could pretend to have character development over that. Pito didn't grow. Yeah. When she lost at the end of the first season. I'm getting madder about this than I am about Orb, which is the sign that I've lost the plot here.
I mean, I think you're right to get madder at it, because whether you may get mad about Orb's particular take, its production is certainly better than Gun Gale Online. Yeah, I share with you this feeling that retrospectively we look at the first season and we go, there was a bit of lightning in the bottle there, and it's out now and it's never coming back. And all that's left is this empty vessel, which will forever be filled with yet more tournament arcs. It's a shame because, as you say, like that ability for a show to talk about the tension between people's personalities inside and outside a game is gone now. And been the last few seasons watching Shangri-La Frontier, and it is another VMMO show, and I think it manages to avoid a lot of the problems that Gun Gale does, and how it does so is kind of instructive, because Gun Gale is a scion of Sword Art. It has always lived within that shadow of that story, asking, as you say, Pitto chasing this life and death urge, and it resolves that at the end of the first season by forcing Pitto to confront that desire for annihilation with her desire for connection with Len, her friendship with Len. Like, she's got to make a decision. Do you keep this promise with Len, or do you follow this thrill-seeking death urge you have? And she's eventually pushed into the latter. And that's a choice. That's choosing connections. And season two, she seems to have lost that desire to form connections at all. There's no substantive difference between the drives of Pitto as a character and Elza Kanzaki as a person. Like, they are one and the same, which is not true of Len. What she does as a character and what she wants as a person are different, and those are something which games allow people to experiment with decisions and personalities and identities that are not their own, and having the tension between those coexisting. Like, it's something that a show can uniquely choose to explore, and it just doesn't anymore. It's just given up on that.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed Shangri-La Frontier because it does engage with the idea that a group of people play a game for very different reasons. Whereas the closest Gun Gale Online takes to that is Len tearing a traumatized military veteran's throat out because to find out if that's her idea of fun. Like, it's a small thing, but I particularly like that Shangri-La Frontier can appreciate the difference. People who engage and find resonance versus stories versus people who actively want to live them out through role play. Like, that's something I've seen time and time again within just playing games. Like, stories are often in video game anime presented as like this very binary relationship. People are either all about the levels and the gear and stuff, or they want to be immersed in this world. They want to live it like a second life. But Shangri-La Frontier has its equivalent of Pitto in a character called Pencil Gun. She's an ambitious, ruthless lady who is just like Pitto, a celebrity outside the game, and she's presented as like the mastermind behind their early efforts to build a group. She's got nearly infinite resources. She betrays her former clan. Like, all the beats are there.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is, in order to get what she wants, she sacrifices all her money. She gives it all away. All her wealth and power are gone because there was a moment of story which she knew just to be a story that resonated with her, and she wanted to see how it resolved. This is a person who wants to know how a story ends, betraying, fighting, doing everything just for a very real reason. People play games to find out how this story ends. Like, humans love stories, and to see like someone fighting because they want to know how someone's story ends is really nice and different to how Gun Gale Online treats it as, oh, you play games for fun. It's fun, everyone. Don't worry.
Yeah, and just the fact that, like, it feels like a revelation that comes from someone who does not play a lot of video games, if I can just be kind of uncharitable. Because, like, of course you do sick, weird shit in video games as, like, a way of like, exploring what sort of things you enjoy. Everyone has locked a sim in a closet or trapped them in a pool and watched them die. And trying to spin that out into a journey of self-discovery requires a defter hand than I think Gun Gale Online is frankly capable of at this point, if ever. So I spent the whole season being annoyed that I was watching it. And granted, part of that is I was watching three great shows. Even Monogatari Series Off and Monster Season was, like, great compared to this kind of intellectually watery, like I feel bad that like I've shown equal levels of opprobrium to Gun Gale Online and Orb, because Orb is trying to say something. It's just so frustrating that Gun Gale Online is not trying to say anything. And just really doesn't have an idea of like what the point of the world it's created is.
I mean, I stick with my empty lightning bottle analogy, Ben. It is just hollow now.
We'll never have an anime about playing PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds with like an experienced guy and having him just like give you the skinny on how to be good at the game. I don't know. It's just.
I'll tell you what is a better anime about hobbies, and that's a negative positive angler, which is a story which starts and explores basically fishing through a lens of which is kind of based on trauma, which is a combination which goes together far more often than you'd think. I swear there's been like a half dozen anime where fishing and trauma are combined. I don't know how we've ended up at this particular cliche, but we have. And negative positive angle starts out with our protagonist Hiro being given 2 years to live. And to him, this basically is drawing a hard line in his future. And it makes everything he's done before in his life building towards something irrelevant. So understandably, his reaction is to drop out of school and to spend money like there's no tomorrow. Because as far as he's concerned, there is. Like, there's no point being a responsible member of society when you're not going to be part of it soon. And so he sits killing time in a pachinko parlor as unopened letters pile up in his room. And it's in that state we meet him. And eventually this leads to him being chased by... I know the word adorable doesn't normally go with debt collectors, but in this particular case, it is an adorably incompetent set of debt collectors. but all that they are there to do is to chase him to the point where he finds himself slipping and falling into a river, from which he's fished out by an oddball group of anglers, which he will spend the rest of the show hanging around with. Hanging around in a supermarket where they all work, which has basically slowly become a fishing store thanks to its staff being obsessed with that and bit by bit replacing its stock. It's a very enjoyable time to spend with them because you've got very distinctive designs. In particular, like lead Lady Hannah has this giant mess of hair. It also has a fair amount more diversity within its cast than anime normally does and avoids a lot of the tropes that go along with them. It's a huge relief to have characters who are queer, who aren't crazy mashers, and foreigners who aren't one-note tropes on a cultural idea. And for it to use the way that animation can focus on the moment-to-moment actions that make up any activity, to the threading of a line, the casting of it, to use that as a way of talking about how mental and physical trauma can draw us away from actually living our lives and how hobbies such as fishing can be a way to be present in the moment and allow us to find a way of processing the world based on how we find it, not on how it may be in the future or how it was in the past. And that's actually pretty good. Like that's more than I was expecting. That's a surprisingly competent message to come out of a anime show about fishing.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing we love about anime, is that anything can be the subject of a deep drill into aspects of the human psyche or human experience.
Now I'm going to do the opposite of a deep drill. I'm going to do a John-style blazing empath through the other anime I've watched this season, and I'll see how quickly I do this. First of all, we've got Mao 2099, which is another show based around genre mashup, except this case it's a literal reality mashup. We follow Demon Lord Veltol, who wakes expecting to be reborn in the medieval society he knew and finds it transformed into a magical cyberpunk dystopia created when two different realities combined. For no reason we're actually told. That's just a thing which happened. We've just got to deal with it.
I pitched my editor on this. Yeah. Stop asking questions.
it's now ruled by one of his evil lieutenants, And all we get is basically the classic temporal fish out of water, with him having to adapt to what was extraordinary in his life becoming ordinary. The one thing I really liked about it is that in the face of all this, he's still self-confident. He still doesn't react in the overawed way which we come to associate with most protagonists in this genre. That kind of makes it all his failures that all the more amusing. Like when someone walks into something absolutely sure they're going to succeed and ends up flat on their face, that's good stuff. I enjoy that.
Yeah.
Its main problem is by the end of the series, he's kind of regained his competency and you've lost that tension. You've lost the comedy aspect and it's still an enjoyable cast to me, but nothing more than that. Next up, Acrotrip.
You were super into this for a while, I feel like.
It was genuinely laugh-out-loud funny on a regular basis. And it was very charming. It's a simple magical girl comedy. That is Shizuko, who's been sent to live with her grandparents for reasons. And on her first day in her new town, she witnesses magical girl Berry Blossom fighting evil Lieutenant Chrome and immediately becomes a huge fangirl of Berry. She just sees that her huge magical attack landing and is just like, wow, so good. Uh-huh. The problem is that in this world, magic can only be used against other magic users. So the moment Chrome is out of commission, Berry Blossom is basically reduced to a glorified Girl Scout around town, trying to help out in the most mundane ways. And Shizuko will not stand for this. Like, she's seen the good stuff and she wants more of it. So... right, Chrome, you got to get back out there. You need to start fighting Berry because I need to with my magical fix. And she's exasperated to find out that you're lazy, you're petulant, you're unambitious. God, I've got to somehow get you to do this job. Otherwise, I'm not getting my good magical girl stuff. So she ends up in the role of kind of like stage director, corralling Chrome into actually being a decent evil lieutenant for Berry to riff against. It does that consummately. It's very funny, but it has a pretty low budget a lot of the time. And considering the default level of animation in our year 2024, I think a lot of people would just get turned off by that, because the baseline that a show has to hit these days has become so much higher. It was below that. It was a very normal looking show. We're in a magical girl moment, apparently. Julie Murray, Magical Girls, Inc. is a workplace comedy about magical girls. So in this show, spells are written as code. It's taking the tech startup analogy route. Magical girls have uniforms. Buildings have to pass a strict supernatural health code. It's bright and it's good looking. Core magical girls, Hitomi and Kana, work together in interesting ways. But ultimately... breaks very little new ground and it isn't funny, which I feel like in any time you are doing a show where you are looking at a genre and commenting upon it, you have to have a sense of humor. When you are just looking at it and going, well, look at this subversion, isn't this interesting, it's like no it's not. Where's your puns? I need a joke here.
Yeah.
It's far too po-faced for me. So after that, we're left with Nina the Starry Bride, Ben, which is very much the Diet Coke of Cork drama. I picked it up due to withdrawal from Crow Court, and
that can cause some really irrational actions.
Yeah,
you should have been more careful.
Heroine Nina is plucked from a life of poverty because of her resemblance to the crown princess who's just been killed in an accident. And so, as is typical, much of the drama comes from this tiny blonde gremlin being unaware and pushing back against court rules. And that's fun, as far as it goes. But because this is a romance, there's a series of hot, bishy princes here to chastise her for pushing against those rules in mildly sadistic ways. It was an aggressively 6 out of 10 show, and once again, below what I would consider the standard for animation these days. It's far too interested in its melodrama to stay in one place long enough to make it interesting. It was forever, oh, there's a new crisis the kingdom must face, and she's pacified this prince, but now she's off to this new prince, and it's very much Diet Coke. Then, and thankfully, we just get to two things I have very little to say about, because firstly, we have already spoken hugely about dead demons, destruction. I am blatantly astonished that it was fall 2024, because it did not. It feels like that happened like a lifetime ago. If nothing else, seeing this on the fall list made me reflect on like the impermanence of human life.
Arguably, it's summer 2024.
Yeah, it depends if you go with a Japanese broadcast and all those things, and also a show that I actually have genuinely loved all the other installments of, which is ReZero. But I'm frankly here to tell you that I refuse to talk about this show because those fuckers threw a feature-length first episode at us, and yet still, Ben, they were unable to finish their damn story arc in their allotted time. If I say it ends on an even more abrupt cliffhanger than Dandadan, then you probably get why I'm so irate about
great.
This.
Yeah.
It was generally quite a poor season, I think. Like, I have always liked ReZero because wonderful character designs. I've enjoyed my time around the witches and all their various extravagantly garbed attendants and our tracksuited hero amongst all this. And to just find myself in a season where it's just identikit bad guys feeling like, oh, you would be a henchman in a different tale, and yet here you are, we have to think of you as a real threat. And it was disappointing, Ben. And I wish this was not the note I had to leave fall 2024, but it is, because ReZero is the last show I had anything to say about.
As it should be, because we can never get away from ReZero, seems like.
Yeah, there'll be another chunk coming at some point now.
Well, that was very thorough. let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll come back and each talk about the one show we're most excited about for the winter 2025 season. And yeah. And we're back. After that lightning round, to save a little bit of time, we're just going to talk about what we're most excited about for the winter 2025 season. I will go ahead and open with a surprise dark horse, because despite me only watching two anime and one of them being Apothecary Diaries, I'm going to have to say that I'm most interested in what's going to happen with Sakamoto Days. Yeah, I know. I've been complaining about it so ceaselessly, and Andy has been an endless font of negativity about where this is going. And I hate how anime does gangster stories. Like, Gungrave is one of the worst anime I've ever had to make myself sit through, and I make myself sit through a lot of anime. But I am open to just having One Punch Man, but it's the mafia, and also he's old and fat, although, as Evirus points out, not actually that old. He's 27 canonically, but I've just been adding 10 years to every single character's age, and it's made me a lot less grumpy as a person.
I mean, as we commented, the average Shonen Jump reader, 27 is ancient, Ben.
So. It's impossibly old.
Yeah.
But, like, gained 100 pounds, grew a math teacher mustache, and went gray is kind of extreme even for that. But the first three episodes have aired. It seems to be falling into a pretty regular pattern of introducing a new wacky assassin, and then Sakamoto just destroys them. But the most recent episode did have this guy whose, like, superpower was having no plan, so that he couldn't be predicted by the psychic guy who is Sakamoto's ally. Sorry, spoilers. But yeah, him instead reading Sakamoto's mind as Sakamoto's just, like, mentally, like, watching them fight and is just, like, saying in his head, like, dodge, duck, right jab, left jab, pull back, feint. It's funny. I haven't watched a lot of comedies lately, which is something I need to, like,
yeah, it's good, it's
fix.
Good to have a mix in your...
But also be careful about fixing, because there's a lot of dog shit comedies out there, as we've literally discussed in the first half of this. But I'm excited, not excited, I'm interested to see where it's going. I generally like the characters. I like that the wife's kind of a yandere, but not like a tedious, like empowered yandere, like Pito from Gun Gale Online. She's just a housewife, and she's just running her convenience store with her like extremely like kind, lovable husband.
I like that she just knows that he used to be assassin. There's no...
Yes, that would be so much worse if he had to hide it from her.
Yeah, it's not...
I mean, he is hiding stuff from her, but...
There's such a common trope in these stories, like, oh, the reformed mafia man's got to hide that he was ever part of the mafia from his wife. Instead, it's like, it's just like, you break the family rules and you're out. And it's like... Number one rule is you don't go back to killing people. It's like, okay, yeah, that's a good rule. That's a good family rule to have.
Also, it's the dumbest joke, but when he's like, here are the rules. It's just like, rule number one, don't kill people. And he's like, that's all the rules. If you break them, I'll kill you. And they're like, that doesn't make sense. Like, I don't know. Andy is really focused on how the comedy is not funny, but the action is good. And that is not my read of the show at all so far. The comedy is mid and the action is irrelevant to my experience. But I mean, at least it's like something to have on screen while I'm waiting. I don't know. Also, we had a Chinese character and she didn't have a racist accent. I'm just going to cheer that every time it happens.
Every time.
Shampoo and this character.
I do feel like, although obviously Japan is a rich vein of Yakuza stories to draw upon, I feel like this is more drawing upon the sort of Hong Kong martial arts films of like the 60s, 70s and 80s in particular, like that idea of the unlikely hero, your overweight assassin, your next door neighbor who just happens to be a stone cold killer. Like I've talked to you before, like how Jackie Chan's like superpower was always just looking like the guy next door, still being amazingly handsome, etc., but still being able to play the guy next door, the humble kid. And I feel like Sakamoto being this on the surface slobbish doting dad, but underneath this stone cold killer, is drawing from the same well that in all the Hong Kong action fairs of my adolescence were drawing.
No, I agree. And like, this is a good moment for it since Shout Factory just acquired the massive, like 150 film Golden Princess library. There's so going to be so much cheap, amazing martial arts action in that vein. And you mentioned Jackie Chan, but I'm going to cite one of his classmates instead, Sammo Hung, who is this big fat guy who is just one of the most like physically amazing kung fu film fighters. Like if you watch him in like SPL or Meals on Wheels, just like
Meals on Wheels is great.
Meals on Wheels is it, I mean, it sucks it has like a terrible name that doesn't evoke a martial arts at all. And it's something that actually I suspect Sakamoto Days won't lean into, because the joke is just that like he moves like a thin man even though he's a fat man. But I do like when media embraces that, like a guy who's approaching 260 pounds, 300 pounds, that is a lot of force you can put behind some stuff. And again, I'm trying to, dear listeners, I'm trying to do better about not suggesting a better version of everything I critique.
I really
don't think this is useless, but like, I do hope that like Sakamoto at some point, the fact that he's fat doesn't become just something that's irrelevant and he's just a thin man who just they happen to draw fat. But it is nice that there is just this like different body type. Like shape diversity is not that common in anime, generally speaking, more so among men than among women, but still I'm at the part where it's fun to watch a very predictable comedy shonen battler. And I'm sure it will disappoint me immensely because I'm so cynical about anime at this point in my life. But at the same time, like, it's been fun. I like the running joke that every time the psychic guy says something that annoys Sakamoto, he just imagines killing him. And then the psychic guy's like, that's really not cool. Like, please stop imagining killing me. And Sakamoto never apologizes. He barely talks, which I also think is a generally good trait, although one that they will probably flanderize to annoyance. Anyway, what are you excited about,
Doug? I was very tempted to talk about Zenshu, which is, as Andy put it, MAPPA choosing to do a very on-the-nose show about an animator who's suffering from burnout, which, considering the scandals they went through, is not necessarily something you can let pass without comment, because obviously, like, that's got all the things I like. It's got genre subversion, it's got winks to the audience, it's got wonderful high budget animation, but it's not the thing I'm most excited about this season. The thing I'm enjoying the most and looking forward to each week is it's just 100 girlfriends who really, really, really love you. It's once again back with a crowd of best girls and the bestest, most impossibly good boyfriend who has ever existed, Aijo Rentaro. And just every episode just being joyous and funny, absolutely consistently laugh out loud funny. Like, you speak about the rarity of comedies, Ben, but you're not, as far as I'm aware, you're not watching this.
That's because I'm a sourpuss. Yeah, no, I own it.
It looks way better than it should as well. Like, it is, of course, slightly etchy because you do not get a title like 100 Girlfriends Who Really, 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 Really Love You and not become slightly etchy, because that would be, as far as anime is concerned, just throwing pearls before swine. Like, if you've got all these great girls and you don't do etchy stuff with them, well, anime looks at you askance. The first episode was just, here's the girls, meet them all again. They're all great. And then straight away, new girlfriend, because 100 Girlfriends has to get 100 girlfriends before it can finish, because Rentaro's fate is to find 100 women and fall completely madly in love with them and have them fall completely madly in love with him. And he will do whatever it takes to give them the best life they can possibly have. And just seeing him completely dote upon new character, in this particular case, hangry girlfriend, Kurumi, who is tiny and constantly hungry. And when she's hungry, she's angry. After she's eaten, she's a sweetie pie. And it's just him being like, okay, I will feed you, my darling. Mm-hmm. And entering the entire Rentaro family as his collection, harem, is now referred to as, in an eating contest, is so she can finally get past her feelings of self-consciousness around the fact that her constant hangriness has left her alone and isolated from other people. Instead, she cooperates with all members of the family in eating contests. It's dumb, it's funny, it's vibrant, and...
Yeah, and I like those designs, good eyebrows, as the only thing Ben engaged with.
They're tens. We've got, I think, four more additional girlfriends this season, and...
Wow, we're not keeping the rate we need to keep up, I guess.
I know.
How are we going to get to 100?
But that's his dilemma, Ben. How can you, for every girlfriend you add, that's less time to spend with the girlfriends you've already made.
Is this a real dilemma in the anime?
I mean, yes.
That he's having trouble with his scheduling of all his girlfriends?
I mean, frankly, have we not mentioned he is a perfect boyfriend, Ben, and therefore...
Oh, of course.
He aces that test every time and finds time for all best girls, frequently destroying himself in the process. It is positive, it is slight, as I say, slightly lecherous, but always funny. I want to recommend it to everyone, Ben, but it's a story about a man with 100 girlfriends. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, anime.txt, like, that is literally like, oh, you've got to watch this show that's about, like, perception and reality and the power of words to shape how we, like, approach meeting. Also, there's lots of panty shots, like a lot of panty shots, and half the girls are underage, and you're like, yeah, I mean, this doesn't seem quite as bad, but it is like a harem anime, which is like, if people are aware of Love Hina or what have you, like, they don't have a high opinion of it unless they're like painted, yeah, like we are, so...
I guess that's why I like Rentaro as a character so much, because he's just such a pure sweetie pie who looks after everyone with everything he has within him. He's after seeing, like, that some of the characters who typically head harems and their sheer dull potato-ness and their lack of any care for the people the half dozen women who fall in love with them, like, fucking hell, we both quite liked early seasons of Index, but every time Toma found his way into that show increased his harem of magical and scientific girls. I just wanted to just wipe him off the screen and just get back to spending time with the characters who are actually interesting, and to have head of the harem actually be someone who gives a damn about them all. And the trope of the harem is always like the harem is unacknowledged. You can never acknowledge the harem. It's like,
no, he's definitely not dating multiple women at the same time with questionable consent on their part.
Whereas this is dating multiple women at a time with absolute consent on their part. Every new girlfriend is introduced to older old girlfriends. Old girlfriends must approve new girlfriend's induction to the Rentaro family formally. And I don't know, it is both very much a beast of convention and breaks those conventions in amusing ways. And that's, I guess that's why I love it, because that's what I want from my anime. I'm poisoned, and I want to be shown the reflection of that poison and made to laugh at the absurdity of it.
I appreciate that it's 100 girlfriends, because like it's an unfulfillable mandate, and yet of course you're going to try to fulfill it. That level of shamelessness. Unfulfillable mandate is our podcast episode title.
This whole bit I'm saying now is getting cut. The other thing that this, we were talking about is 100 beavers. Then my mind went to
100 girlfriends who really love you, possibly thousands. This is the joy of media, of intertextuality, of remix.
But not 100 beavers who really, 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 really.
100 beavers who really. Are we just going to have multiple episode titles based on 100 girlfriends who really. Is that our little sister can't possibly be this cute? Is it wrong to pick up. Is it wrong to pick up beavers in the hundreds? Okay, now you can't cut this. I need to pick up. I'm going to watch Girl Bands Cry. I'm downloading it right now. Well, I'm not downloading. I've got it queued up to download after the podcast ends. I need to watch more shows this season. It's embarrassing that I'm just watching this in Apothecary Diaries. And I like Apothecary Diaries. Are you caught up?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good.
Yeah. I do feel. I miss Crow Court. And I feel like there's a leisureliness to Apothecary Diaries that Crow Court dispensed with in a way that I think is exciting. But I do like Mau Mau. I do like this thing. I do like, it puts me in mind of, in Delicious in Dungeon, you remember, where they're like, oh yeah, most meat has parasites in it and you have to prepare it properly to not get parasites yourself. This being like, oh yeah, there are a lot of abortifacients just floating around in a pre-modern court, and like, not like a lot of them aren't known because it doesn't matter unless you drink a gallon of jasmine tea. But so I enjoy that. And clearly we're two episodes into the next season. So like we're in no way approaching the big plot.
It is still more Apothecary Diaries. And
yeah,
maybe there's been a small drop in quality, but me, it's like a small drop of quality from extremely good to just very, very good most of the time. Maybe cutting to stills a bit more often than they used to. Fine. More than fine. It doesn't need this much. No sign of the CGI horses so far, so there's relief in that. But I like we are establishing the ubiquity of these things. It's not that you have to be some genius to find a harmful substance. You just have to have the knowledge to know it is all around you. And that I think you haven't seen the third episode.
No, I have not, I'm afraid.
And the third episode is very much talking about what can happen when people attempt to weaponize these things and don't realize just how dangerous the thing they're dealing with is. I think that's an important thing to get across within the wider wow cool poison genre.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that's the long price is what's great about court dramas, and it's nice that now that we're in a second season to have like that set up, and we know that's going to pay off. And watching Mau Mau be like trying to restrict how big of a conspiracy she's seeing, I can't wait to watch the third episode because I've generally been dead for the past month plus.
Like that acknowledgement that we as viewers are doing the same thing that Mau Mau is, and we're seeing plots everywhere. We're trying to connect the dots and to sometimes go, well, maybe there wasn't any dots to connect here. Maybe it is just noise. And to regulate your tendencies to hyperfixate on patterns, because all humans want patterns. It's not something unique to Mau Mau. It's something everyone has. And as a character, what distinguishes her is not that she's seeing patterns. It's that she is self-critical of those patterns. She will interrogate those patterns and say, why is this pattern wrong? Why should I doubt this pattern? Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes it superior to most detective shows, because the detective has self-doubt, and that's what makes them a good detective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm excited to see more. And it's very funny that we just had like our most substantive discussion about something that was neither of our picks, because we just assume it's going to be great. That's anime, I suppose.
100 mushrooms that will
100 mushrooms that will get you really, really high.
It's the gift which keeps on giving.
Yeah, we can just keep doing puns. Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up there. We haven't had a twofer in a while, outside of the tweens, and so this has been nice. It's the Ben and Duncan show, always at the heart. The two most egregious overt, well, that's not true, Jeff exists, but one of two of the most egregious over intellectualizers on the podcast, just talking about all this dog shit anime we watched. But yeah, so speaking of, next month, tune in, we are going to be doing a show on girls and bands, and some of them cry. Actually, I think all of them cry at some point or another, but only in one is it a titular emotional episode. So, yeah, tune in for that. Check out Girls Band Cry. Check out Bocchi the Rock. Rewatch K-On. You'll be happy. You're welcome.
It's not just girls who cry, though. I'll also be doing some Girls Who Dream, and it's their go.
Do they cry in those dreams?
I don't think there's 100 of them. I don't know yet if I'll really, really love them.
I mean, there's always 100 potential girlfriends, at least. We have to admit, ontologically. But in the meantime, rate and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook. Search for Keyframes Podcast. I'll have to deal with that in the coming months as the head of Meta continues to be a fascist weirdo. But for now, we're still on Facebook. Let's build a community that is separate from all this bullshit. Find us on Twitter and on Blue Sky at Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. If you email us, we will discuss your email extensively privately and at least acknowledge it extensively publicly. In fact, we have a lovely email that we would be reading in this episode, except Jeff's not here. So check in next time. And most of all, tell a friend.
But not just any friend, Ben. Tell a friend who spends all his time saying, you know what, I love girl band shows. I stan every girl band show. Music is my life. Music is my passion. And all these girls are amazing. In fact, I'm going to create a new girl group. It's going to have 100 girls. And we're going to do exclusively love songs.
100 girlfriends who really, really, really love to jam.
Yeah. No, 100 girlfriends who really, really rock.
Say goodbye.
Really, really goodbye.
Really, really, really need to end this podcast.